the people who have integrated security at the highest level within their organizations, those teams are actually able to remediate their critical vulnerabilities much faster than any of the other cohorts.
Hi, you're listening to The Secure Developer. It's part of the My DevSecOps community, a platform for developers, operators, and security people to share their views and practices on DevSecOps, Dev and Sec collaboration, cloud security, and more. Check out mydevsecops.io to join the community and find other great resources. This podcast is sponsored by Sneak. Sneak is a dev-first security company helping companies fix vulnerabilities in open source components and containers without slowing down development. To learn more, visit sneak.io.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for tuning back in to The Secure Developer. I'm Guy Pujarini, and today we're going to have a different format episode. In this show, you hear a lot of opinions and experiences from people trying to tackle security and development or DevSecOps, and I think those are very valuable. But in this specific episode, we'll try to focus on data, you know, and we have some great guests who dug into more broad data around what works and what doesn't work. And we'll kind of get a bit of an inkling to some of these sort of great data perspectives. So we have three great guests. I'm going to call them out and let them introduce themselves. First, we have Alana Brown, who's been spearheading the DevOps State of DevOps report at Puppet. Alana, thanks for tuning in. Can you tell us a couple of words about yourself?
Sure. Thank you so much, Guy, for having me on your podcast. I'm Alana Brown. I work at Puppet. I started the State of DevOps report back in 2012, if you can believe that, back when there were no codified DevOps tool chains. There were no DevOps engineers. DevOps was certainly not a household brand or name at that time. And it's been kind of amazing to head up this research for the past 8 years and kind of see the growth of the DevOps space.
That's awesome. Yeah, definitely become one of the key assets or sort of key data insights into the ecosystem. We also have Gareth Rushgrove from here at Sneak. Gareth, I'll let you introduce yourself and the recent infrastructure as code work you've done.
Thanks, Guy. So I'm Gareth Rushgrove. I'm currently one of the product directors at Sneak. I was actually previously colleague of Alana over at Puppet, and I've been sort of around the DevOps sort of space for a while. I'm also the curator of DevOps Weekly, which I started 10 years ago. Most recently, I've been doing a bunch of work around infrastructure as code, so overlapping some of my interests from Puppet and Sneak, looking at like how we can better secure infrastructure via that infrastructure as code.
Cool. Thanks, Gareth. And last but very much not least, you know, we have a guest that we've had the pleasure of having on the show not too long ago, talking about sort of the DevSecOps Hub and practices. We have Alisa Miller from Sneak as well. Alisa, can you say a couple of words about yourself and the state of open source security?
Sure. Yeah. My name is Alisa Miller. I'm an application security advocate here at Sneak. So, you know, I was a developer for about a decade before I got into security. I've spent almost the next 15 years working in specifically the application security space more than anything else. And recently we completed research and authoring of the State of Open Source Security Report, which draws together a lot of different data sources from Sneak, from the open source community, and even surveys that we conducted within the various developer security and operations communities.
Awesome. So again, thanks everybody for joining here as guests. Let's kind of go through a bunch of questions or perspectives of security. Maybe we start with just the status of, you know, where things stand. How vulnerable are we, you know, in terms of looking at the security of the current ecosystem? Alisa, maybe we'll start with you a little bit. You've done some inspection of vulnerability state with the latest report. How do we fare? What's the current status?
Yeah, so we looked at a lot of, you know, just overall growth of the ecosystems, first of all, and certainly open source continues to grow amazingly quickly at over 100% rate overall, just looking at the number of packages available. And so one of the stats we like to track just are the number of vulnerabilities that are being identified across the various open source ecosystems. And while certainly, of course, we saw new vulnerabilities this year like we would see every year, the rate at which we saw new vulnerabilities actually dropped a little bit. So there weren't quite as many new vulnerabilities reported this year as we saw last year. So that's I mean, 1 year does not a trend make by any stretch of the imagination, but certainly something that we're going to keep an eye on because, boy, that would be a really encouraging thing to see. Conversely, you know, we expand beyond just open source packages. We did look at the container world as well and just some of the top official images with Docker Hub, and a little bit different story there. There we're seeing those official container images. They still, some particular outliers are really notable in terms of just the number of vulnerabilities that exist in those official images out there. So yeah, kind of a mixed bag. You know, I think we're seeing, and we'll talk more about it, I'm sure, but definitely security practices being more adopted, more of a DevSecOps culture being looked at. But I know Gareth and Alana have a lot to add in terms of those particular subjects as well.
Definitely, you know, like some line of hope, you know, but especially on the container side, you know, sounds like we haven't quite made as much progress as possible. I mean, I know, Gareth, Alana, what have you sort of seen in this space? Does it match the data in your own researches?
Well, I'll jump in and say that every year we do look at specific performance outcomes. And I think relevant to this conversation, last year we looked at the time to remediate critical security vulnerabilities. And what we found is that the people who have integrated security at the highest level within their organizations, those teams are actually able to remediate their critical vulnerabilities much faster than any of the other cohorts. We did look at specific bans, and only 7% of our total respondents were actually able to remediate a critical vulnerability in less than 1 hour, which, you know, 1 hour is very short time to do so. The majority of the respondents, however, were able to remediate in less than a week. And I think, you know, just seeing all these bans, I think the main takeaway for me is that it is actually really hard to reduce the time it takes to remediate vulnerabilities, simply because there are just so many factors involved in that process. There are too many stakeholders, too many handoffs, too many approvals. And so to do that on the back end is pretty hard. And although the differences between each of those levels are statistically significant, they're not as dramatic as we would typically like to see between those who have integrated security pretty deeply and consistently and those that haven't. But still, that said, I think any reduction in it is a good thing in general because it still does help reduce your company's risk and exposure.
Jump on the point Lisa made about container images being the sort of an area that like needs attention, like, because partly container images are just a component of something, and most applications consist of multiple services or you're running many things. And so a lot of the development effort has moved to higher level tools that are composing multiple images together, and that security sort of foundation isn't there. So like some of the research we did into Helm charts, looking at the Helm sort of stable repository. There's loads of good stuff in there. Like, and there's when we looked, there were nearly 300 stable charts, and there's more now. But 68% of them had an image with a high severity vulnerability in, and roughly the same sort of amount of like sort of order of magnitude, like 64% of them had like outdated images. There's this constant problem of keeping everything up to date. And where you don't, it has a knock-on effect. So if your software is not up to date, your applications are insecure. If your packaging isn't up to date, you're insecure. If your how you're orchestrating those things together isn't up to date, you're insecure. It's multiple layers, and you miss one and it has a knock-on effect. I think that's sort of interesting.
Yeah.
Like we need to build on secure foundations in order to build secure applications.
It's interesting. So like we're sort of seeing a picture here, there's the total number of vulnerabilities in the ecosystem, which, you know, maybe we have some inkling of hope there with a reduction in the total. But then we have these complex systems that increasingly just have more opportunities to draw them in. You know, you're composing multiple containers. And so there's some multiplier effect of saying you might be slightly less likely to have a vulnerability in one of those, but you're going to have more of those components. So maybe combined, you get to that sort of 68% stat. I'm interested in just I think there was a little bit of a discrepancy in the different data perspectives. I know, Alana, you describe, you know, when people are, you know, are asked, I think it's survey based, right? You know, they're asked, how quickly do you address a vulnerability? At least there's an echelon there, sort of a top echelon that is doing this in 1 hour, the others in sort of a day or in a week. At least I think that doesn't quite match some of the data that you've seen, no?
Yeah, and that's true. And that's what's really kind of interesting. So within the State of Open Source Security report, we had the opportunity to actually ask the question as a survey question about vulnerability remediation timelines. But then because we have access to aggregated data from the scans that people are performing on their software, we're actually able to look at what are some of those remediation timelines in reality. So, it, you know, in our survey we asked, and when we asked about vulnerability remediation, we saw, you know, 26% that said they would expect it in a day or less. Well over 65% said, you know, definitely in a week or less. But when we go and we look at the actual data of what these organizations are achieving in terms of remediation, we see less, just about 1% that are actually fixing vulnerabilities in the same day. And these are vulnerabilities that have fixes available. You know, 34% took 20 days or less. But what's alarming then is the remaining 65% that are 20 days or longer, and 36% of those are 70 days or longer. We saw kind of the mean was about 62 days to fix a vulnerability. The max that we saw was in lengths of years. And so it's interesting to see that disconnect. And it's one of the things we drew out in that report is a lot of people, there's a lot of expectation and a lot of belief that we're better at fixing vulnerabilities than we really are when we look at some of the data that's available. And so it's, you know, I almost hate to say it because it feels like this little gotcha scenario we pulled out there, but it was really, it's an interesting story when you look at that and you can see how expectations don't always jive with reality. And indeed, you know, one of the fascinating pieces that we're just starting to dig into now is, okay, who answered how as far as their roles within the organization? And you'll definitely see some upcoming updates from us on that as well. Just, you know, the hypothesis maybe being, you know, is it people at higher levels of management who expect these short timeframes? And then, you know, the reality is when you're down at a core developer level, maybe the expectations are different. And we'll definitely something we're still digging into and want to see what the data tells us there.
We all want to rapidly speculate on this, but like it's a data show. So we should be like, we're sticking to data. All of us want to go like, oh, I think it's this and this and this. I can tell.
Well, I will say, and this is data-based, people do tend to have a rosier view of what's going on when they take a survey, especially executives. So I think it's wise that you would segment by level, because the higher up in the org, the tendency is to kind of paint a rosier picture of everything. And so I think that that's fascinating. And the other thing that I think is slightly nuanced is that we did ask about critical vulnerabilities versus all vulnerabilities. And so I don't know if you're able to split out your data based on the severity.
That's unfortunately for the report we didn't, but that is another piece. That's one of the great things about the way we work with this data is it's kind of evergreen. We can keep, you know, dissecting it and pulling it apart. I don't mean to speculate, but obviously part of any study you do is setting a hypothesis and then seeing does the data actually match that, because it guides your data analysis. And that's what we're trying to do is it's like, is that maybe the case or is there something else at play? And that's a very good question, too, that we do want to dig further into is understanding how do those remediation timelines shift if I'm talking about something that's critical, high CVSS score versus something that's very low severity and perhaps maybe, you know, those are being left to take longer the way you would hope that things are, that we prioritize those more critical vulnerabilities.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I think data is hard, you know, and there are a lot of nuances and it's hard to complicate, but it's interesting, you know, a couple of interesting theories, which as you point out, Gareth, you're right that, you know, it's easy to theorize and then we need to collect the data to do it around, you know, the difference between survey and reality, between seniority and definitely between how do we approach different severities and what are those different timelines. Maybe let's sort of shift. So this is a little bit about where we are and maybe how quickly we respond to these vulnerabilities. Maybe let's talk a little bit about the security practices, right? And different security controls, you know, which ones are deployed and, you know, which ones are effective or not. Alana, you had some great data about the, sort of these practices and their effectiveness in the state of DevOps. Do you wanna share a bit more?
Yeah, absolutely. And so we always try to take a very pragmatic approach with the state of DevOps report, and we're really interested in seeing and understanding what practices are actually helping to move the needle. And so one of the questions we asked was, do your org's security processes and policies actually improve your security posture? Because we're trying to get at this idea of, like, is this all just security theater, or do you actually have confidence in your security practices? And security posture, I just want to say, is really hard to measure directly for a firm. And so you have to measure it indirectly. And so we did that by asking about the sentiment around security and confidence in security posture. But if anyone knows of any studies around security posture, please let me know, because I would love to see what kinds of measures people use. But I think this is probably one of my favorite findings in the whole report last year. But we found that at the highest level of security integration, teams are actually more than twice as confident in their security posture. And so 81% of the respondents that were at high integration, they'd fully integrated security into their software delivery lifecycle, they felt that their security policies and practices improved their security posture. And then at firms with no security integration, where it's just completely ad hoc, just 38% had that same level of confidence. Now, I did mention this earlier, but it doesn't mean that they are more secure. But I think what's important to note here is there's this shift in mindset that has happened, and the mindset that security considerations are not separate from software design and software creation, and that it's not just the sole responsibility of one team. We see that movement as people start to integrate security more deeply. And so we looked at a bunch of practices, and we ranked all those different security practices by their effect on security posture. And it was so fascinating, because when we stack ranked them, the top five were things like security and development teams collaborate on threat models. And Alyssa, I know that's going to make you happy. And security tools are integrated into the development pipeline, so developers can fix issues immediately. And Guy, I know you're pretty passionate about this yourself. Security requirements, both the functional and the non-functional ones, are prioritized as part of a product backlog. Infrastructure-related security policies are reviewed before deployment. And security experts are evaluating automated tests. So they're not doing the tests themselves. You know, they're not manually doing the performing those tests. They're evaluating automated tests, and they're really only using that manual function to review changes in some of the high-risk areas of the code. And what I think, what is stunning to me actually, is that all of these practices rely on deep collaboration across these functional boundaries, and they happen really early in the development life cycle. And so technology, of course, is helpful, but ultimately it should facilitate that level of collaboration.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, first of all, it's great to hear, you know, validation to what we've been preaching, that is indeed, you know, data driven. But collaboration is kind of hard. I know, like, Alyssa, what did we see? What does the state of open source security show in terms of what types of practices are embraced on kind of that audience?
Yeah. So I mean, it was kind of impressive to see. In fact, honestly, talking with these organizations in the survey, over 57% that said they've got some form of source code analysis in place. They're doing some type of static analysis. That was really impressive. And indeed, too, when we look at how many of those have integrations into, you know, or automations rather, into their security pipelines or their delivery pipelines, you know, almost 50% said that they've got some type of static analysis and even software composition analysis, both being integrated into those pipelines, which of course, when we start talking about developer enablement and how we're trying to get there and create this frictionless environment where developers can quickly and easily respond with short feedback loops to vulnerabilities that have been introduced, getting that type of automation in the pipeline that early on is a crucial element. So we saw a lot of that. On the less encouraging side was we did ask about some very specific practices trying to drive that sort of culture of shared responsibility. And we were hoping to see more collaboration, but these were very specific practices, things like having security champions programs. Only 15% of organizations were doing that. Also setting up just daily integrations or weekly integrations or functional integrations between the various areas, security, developers, and ops, in terms of do your security people go to your stand-ups and so forth. And there again, only 16%. So there's definitely more room to continue to create that collaboration, but hearing that key security practices, like Alana, you mentioned threat modeling, my love for threat modeling, and this is why, because it does create that collaboration between the business and the development teams and the security teams and the operational teams all coming together to really talk about this system and how to make it secure. So it is promising to hear you say that there's growth in that space and that organizations seem to see the value in terms of their confidence being boosted when they're doing those types of activities.
Well, just to kind of finish that thought also, Alyssa, we looked at all the practices that you mentioned, like static code analysis, dependency checkers, pen testing, domain application tests, all of that stuff too. And while they are very high frequency, so people are using them, they had less of an effect on security posture than the actual lower frequency practices like threat modeling that really do require a lot of collaboration.
And I guess we're again slightly comparing different sticks or sort of measuring sticks to those elements, in the sense that we're sort of measuring it based on kind of perceived security posture, right? Which is probably decent, sort of as good a barometer as any in this sort of a murky measurement of the security world. But it's interesting to also consider whether it's how much people get desensitized, basically, once a security practice becomes a part of the core of how they build software, how much do they no longer learn to appreciate its contribution to their security posture.
Some of the things that came up with the survey we did around application infrastructure as code tooling, it's sort of interesting following up on this, because I guess in that space it's early for lots of organizations adopting them, but it's also early for them considering the security implications of what they're doing there. And one of the things that came out of the survey we did that was more than 50% of respondents rely on manual code reviews, or late stage sort of penetration testing and auditing. They're like, oh, yep. Basically, it's all manual or it's very much batch and later. And it's interesting that obviously the observations you're saying about the benefits of shifting things to earlier in the process, that the part that actually I found slightly more frightening on top of that was, I guess that makes sense in the context of it's an early adopter thing. 75% of respondents said they were somewhat or not confident at all in spotting issues via manual reviews. Even accounting for those being separate, a large chunk of people, they're like, yep, we're doing code reviews. Nope, we're not at all confident in finding anything. It's very, that sort of was interesting, I felt, in this light of thinking about practices, thinking about evolving practices for the newer parts of the stack that people are adopting. But they're obviously sort of copying, they're paraphrasing, they're parroting things that they've done before. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see how that evolves over the next few years.
Yeah, it's fascinating. It's a new practice, but then people just revert to a methodology that seems right, but they haven't actually built any level of confidence in that methodology being the right element. I have so there's actually an interesting data bit from a previous guest, Larry Maccheroni from Comcast, and they have actually that's a whole data episode on its own, and he's taken a very data-driven approach to driving kind of security transformation within Comcast. They measure security, or he measures security, through basically the vulnerability counts and pace of remediation. So somewhat technical, but still very measurable means of sort of saying, okay, like, are people training up, training down? How many vulnerabilities do they have proportional to the amount of work that they have? And then they've measured, you know, they've mapped out many, I think 20 or so, if memory serves me right, the different security practices. They're tackling a subset of them as they evolve. But there were all sorts of interesting tidbits that he pointed out about ineffective practices. Two that stayed with me are, you know, one, people that had, or sort of groups, so he's comparing different groups within Comcast that have or have not embraced a certain security practice. Those that have embraced a security practice of finding vulnerabilities but have no structured program for fixing those vulnerabilities are actually worse off in terms of their eventual security posture than the ones that didn't embrace any vulnerability discovery at all. So you're basically, you're better off not looking for vulnerabilities than having a vulnerability program that doesn't have a remediation plan built into it, which is interesting. It slightly makes sense when you sort of stop to think about it, but you know, whether it's the cycles involved or it's a sense of ownership because they just diminish it. But he has kind of clear data to show that correlation, which I thought was fascinating. And the second one, which is also not intuitive, is they showed basic training, which everybody had to go, basic security training, all the developers had to go through. And they've had a more advanced training where you had to pick someone to do this more rigorous security training. And it wasn't like the manager had to sort of pick someone on the team and send it. And that more advanced training ended up reducing the overall security posture of that team. The basic training improved it. They did a lot. And so they saw that data, and the theory was, and this is kind of his words, is basically when you had to pick someone and take them away from daily work and do investments, and the managers had to pick the individual, they didn't necessarily pick the most capable individual on the team to kind of run that type of test. They might have sent whoever was least damaging to sort of lose cycles for that person to go to this deep security training. But then once they did, too much of the responsibility fell to that person. The rest of the teammates didn't shake it off. Now, granted, again, that's theory, but that first bit of the result is data. So, and some fascinating, just counterintuitive evolutions on measuring security and the effectiveness of these different controls. So we've talked about our current state. We talked about some practices and, you know, whether they are good or not. Although we touched on people because collaboration was a key component of the practices that seem most effective. And also maybe people have made some decisions around embracing a security control that they don't necessarily think is effective. But another big question that comes up in the world of DevSecOps and developers and security is one of ownership, right? Of who should tackle, you know, or who should be the lead or take different responsibilities for these security concerns. And so I think like each one of these sources or these data sources we have here have touched on this element of ownership. I think, Gareth, maybe we can start with you this time. You know, did you ask any questions around sort of infrastructure as code security and who should be responsible for it?
Yes. So interestingly, you said should, because we actually asked around like sort of both the hypothetical, sort of in a perfect world, given that things are evolving, given this desire, and frankly, there was a desire to shift left when 77% of respondents said, like, yeah, this should be moving to the application teams. The reality was much messier. So roughly speaking, this split pretty much into thirds between some organizations where it was the main preserve of developers, others had a sort of central platform or DevOps team or structure in place in the middle. For others, this was very much like an infrastructure sort of domain. It was someone else, somewhere else. But in lots of cases, it was also the responsibilities crossed boundaries. So most respondents basically said it was the responsibility of more than one party. So organizations with security teams often had those involved. Others had like more spread out sort of organization structures. I think the difference between the desire and the reality, I think, was probably the most interesting thing that came out there around like the sort of people angle on the like looking at infrastructure as code. Again, I think it again, makes sense in the sense that like a lot of the, for a lot of these organizations, they're at an early stage of adoption and it's often been incubated in one place. But it's also interesting that their desire is to head in the direction of making these things addressable to developers, which sounds like a good thing given some of the data points we've talked about already.
Yeah, indeed. Just earlier in the process.
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating because I almost look at it differently, right? Like, I think when we talk DevSecOps, you know, really what we're looking for is that culture. I always refer to it as that shared responsibility culture, right? Where you've got, you know, you've got these three disciplines that we officially lump into DevSecOps. And I also a really big proponent of bringing the business into that as well. And I think we've seen, especially as cloud native technologies, infrastructure as code, containers, all these things come up and more developers are being charged with creating that, that yeah, we, and somewhat rightfully so, we put the responsibility on those application developers to secure those things. You're the one creating it. We know, hey, from 2 decades of talking about push left, yeah, we want to get early, and to do that, we need the developers to take care of this. But I also think back to a really great tweet I saw from Kelsey Hightower a number of months ago where he says, you know, if you want to roll your own application platform, here you go. All you need to know is Linux and Kubernetes and Docker. And he just rattles off this laundry list of all the technologies. And it's like, you know, it gets you thinking, we're putting an awful lot of onus on one group of individuals that are a part of that pipeline. The reality is we want to see that spread and we want to see all of those. I mean, that's the point of DevSecOps, right? Is really that we've got all of these groups of individuals who've broken down the silos now and have come together to work together. And so we asked in the state of open source security, who should be responsible for the security of your software and the security of your infrastructure? Now, last year when we asked that question about software, we didn't ask the infrastructure side, we asked just the software side. It was actually a little alarming. We saw exactly that. 85% said that developers should be responsible for the security of the software. Yeah, that's great. But then only 23% thought security had a role in it, and only 21% thought infrastructure had a role in it. I'm like, wait, shouldn't those all be approaching 100%? Like, we want everybody involved. So this year when we asked it again about software in particular, it was much more encouraging. We saw that same 85% for developers. Okay, great. I'm kind of curious what the other 15% see as developers' role in security. But we did see security come up quite a bit. So 55%. Operations still kind of gets forgotten about on the software side. They're down there at 35%. And I guess to some degree, I can kind of accept that because, you know, how much of a role do they play in the actual application itself? Maybe not as much. But when we think about things like the threat modeling and some of those collaborative pieces we'd like to see, that's where we'd like to see that rise. Yeah. On the infrastructure side, it was a little bit better. It was basically 63% said developers, 56% included security team, and another 56% operations. I'm a little surprised operations didn't go way up. But so it's telling that like we are seeing attitudes change a bit where the idea of breaking down the barriers of those silos and bringing everyone into that kind of common focus, that at least that's starting to grow. After 12 years of doing DevOps, it's good to see that happening. So, but I'm kind of curious too, from Alana's perspective, because I know you guys, I think you guys had some data on this too, around some of that.
We did, and we actually asked a question about security and shared responsibility. I don't love the way that we asked the question because I think it can be misinterpreted, but I will share the data because I think it's interesting. So we asked, you know, do you agree that security is a shared responsibility across your delivery and security teams? And I think a positive outcome is that as security integration goes up, as it's more deeply integrated, that level of agreement goes up as well. So, you know, no integration, only 58% really felt that security was a shared responsibility versus at full integration, it was at 89%. So that's a 31-point difference. And I think that is a positive trend. And I think it totally makes sense. Like the more integrated security is, the more likely everyone is to feel that it is a shared responsibility. Now, I do want to note, though, that like you go to these DevOps conferences and everything seems so rosy and the path seems so straightforward, but it's really not. The integrating security is actually really messy work, and especially in those middle stages after you've already tackled all of the low-hanging fruit. And we call this is called the J curve. So if you can imagine the Nike swoosh symbol, you know, where things kind of start out pretty high, you're getting some quick wins, and then they quickly dip down, because then you're starting to unpack all of that complexity and it gets really messy. You kind of have to muddle through things in order for them to get better again. So that's called the J curve. And we ask teams specifically if they encounter friction when they're collaborating between you know, security and delivery teams. And the friction actually tends to get higher in the middle as people are collaborating more. And it does start to decline at the higher levels of integration, but it never fully goes away. And, you know, Nigel, Kristen, and I, who's one of the co-authors of the report, we debated about this, and we believe that it's productive friction at that point, but we don't know. It's just a theory. And then when we look at the people who are in security roles versus non-security roles, the friction is like off the charts for them during those middle levels. And, you know, I think we all have to understand that DevOps is fundamentally a cultural change. And so different teams are going to experience that change differently. And if you're a leader, an IT leader or a security leader, I think you have to be really cognizant of that to help your teams move through that change.
Yeah, that's super insightful. It's hard, you know, sort of culture change is hard. And I do think that as we talk about, hey, developers should embrace security, developers should pick this up, we don't always recognize, you know, I think in this specific podcast, you know, we have a lot of security leaders. So I think there's maybe some empathy, you know, and some recognition of the difficulty in the change on the security side as well. But still, there's a lot of, like, I think sometimes there's a tendency to sort of glorify the developer part and how they're sort of embracing security and not appreciate the challenge that, you know, the people maybe on the governance and security side need to face in the process.
I think especially given like the evolution of some of the words we're using. So talking about operations and talking about infrastructure, you can get quite meta into what is infrastructure? What is operations? What do we mean? What is the application? All these words that you can take for granted, and you can have a conversation without even remotely thinking about or agreeing on the definitions. But actually, if you step back, like especially from a sort of cutting edge perspective, like today versus 10, 15 years ago, the words have very different meaning. And I think one of the things we see in surveys and conversations is you can ask a question, it means different things to different people. There's not really a way around that. English isn't the ideal language. Maybe you can avoid it in languages that are more precise, but we just reuse the words. And I think that's interesting. Like, I'm both from a data perspective, it makes that job harder, but also from that empathy perspective, like, what is an application? Like, I'm an application developer. Are you doing the same thing as you were 10 years ago? Yes, you're building an application. What's the scope of that application? That's changed. And yeah, we've brought often application developers, I guess we talk about application teams. Those teams have changed. Those teams have people who would have traditionally been in a security org separately somewhere else in another building, and they have people in them from who would have traditionally been down the road in IT. I think that's interesting. It's some of the, it's harder to get to in the data of these questions, but I think it shines a light on some of it in an interesting way.
Spot on. And infrastructure as code is case in point. You know, it's, hold on, should you secure it like infrastructure or should you secure it like code, you know, which of these practices and building those apps? So there's been a lot of data floating around here, and I think different opinions. And I really like how the data points in similar directions, and there's a lot of verification of it, not always in the same direction. Sometimes it's because we can ask a question in different ways, and sometimes because data is messy and it's complicated, and the same question can have two different answers if different people are answering it or depending on the nuance of the question. Maybe just to sort of close off here, and as you know, I think we're probably most listeners are at the edge of their sort of data capacity. I like to ask every guest coming on the show, you know, for sort of one bit of advice to think, okay, if you want to sort of be set on a path to improve, and what would sort of one bit of advice be? Ideally data-driven, but I think this is a place where we can slightly deviate and be more opinions or sort of interpretations of the data here. So maybe we'll do like some quick advice from each of you. Alana, why don't we start with you?
Well, I think what the data actually shows us is that we need a more holistic approach to security. And it's one that integrates security throughout the software delivery lifecycle, starting with identifying security requirements during the requirements phase, following secure coding practices and standards, continuously testing for vulnerabilities and automating those tests, comprehensive logging and monitoring in production. And so it's a whole bunch of things, but in totality, I think all of this really relies on good collaboration, sharing, automation, measurement, and basically all the foundations of good DevOps practices.
Definitely. Like basically, if you do DevOps well, you'd be on a much better path to sort of doing DevSecOps well in that process. Alisa, what do you think? What would be your bit here?
Yeah, so I'll actually build on what Alana was saying, because this is something I've been trying to stress, especially in the security community, where you know, DevOps kind of ran off and did its thing, and we were kind of caught on our heels. Like, how do we get involved? How do we keep ourselves a part of this? And it really comes down to, we're talking about this integration. You notice when Alana said that, she didn't say put security between those phases. We still, in security, we tend to think about implementing security in the pipeline as gates between phases of the pipeline. I mean, I actually just read a blog on it where they actually used the word gates. And it's like, no, those are the things we need to break down. So that's where the automation comes into play for sure. But also just that collaboration of individuals, having functionally people working together inside each of those phases. So security is no longer this separate thing that occurs at the end of a phase. It's integrated into it. And now we're enabling the people that are responsible for those phases to complete those security practices, whether they're security practitioners, developers, business people, whomever they are. And that's what I think from, in particular, security perspective, we really need to be focused on, because that's what's going to get our practices adopted as part of the pipeline.
Love it. Have to sort of rethink it, sort of, you know, like change the way you think about it, not as security in between, but rather, you know, weaved in and sort of, you know, a natural part of the fabric. Jareth, how about yourself?
Yeah, I would drill down a little bit on, so one of the things we saw with the infrastructure as code work was some of that sort of low adoption and sort of reticence around security or misunderstanding of security, like around that, was an expertise problem. Like, and people had low confidence. They were talking about sort of lack of training, lack of mentoring, lack of support and guidance. And I think that's a big opportunity for, like, probably not just that area, but any sort of new. If you're doing something new, appreciating early that it has security implication, nearly everything does. And I think filling that gap, how do you fill the expertise gap? If you go from having like one person who's going to be super busy as you scale something out to scaling that expertise across a number of people, they can do that again. And I think for new areas, focusing on expertise and like really making that available, your story of sort of not working in certain ways and finding like what works, finding how to measure it, I think is very interesting. But yeah, how do you get expertise broadly applied in a way that actually then makes the rest of it later easier? And I think to our point of like collaboration, like if you can come up with good mentoring programs and training programs that bring people together and put them in the same room, like that connective tissue can be super useful later. They'll learn the same things and they'll learn them together. Hopefully then they apply the same things and they apply them together.
Yeah, no, perfect. You know, you basically lend each other's expertise and work together. So this has been excellent. Thanks to all of you for collecting this data and sort of, you know, sharing it and for coming onto the podcast. I hope all those of you tuning in, I hope you found this, the data itself and the format interesting. And I hope you join us for the next one.
Thanks for listening to The Secure Developer. That's all we have time for today. For additional episodes and full transcriptions, visit mydevsecops.io. If you'd like to be a guest on the show or get involved in the community, you can also find us on Twitter at @mydevsecops. Don't forget to leave us a review on iTunes if you enjoyed today's episode. Bye for now.